Okay, we're in Romans 4, and we've finished up there. We can turn back to Romans 4. We're going to do a little jumping around today. Romans 4, and we just covered this life of Abraham. And it's important to see, we kind of put this up again. We're not going to have too much more time here, but I just wanted to bring up this timeline for his life. And see, what God's and Paul is doing here in Romans 4 is Paul has his critics, his enemies, and he's saying Paul's apostleship can't be right. It can't be correct, because if it is, then that would be contrary to what God's done in the past. It wouldn't be consistent with who God is. And in Romans 3, we saw that's one thing with justification. They were saying, Paul says God justifies ungodly sinners on enemy status before him. Well, if that's right, Paul, that would make God an unjust judge. And Paul says, no, the main point in that Romans 3 is in the very act of justifying ungodly sinners. At that very point, God declares, and again I say declares, his righteousness. Why? How can God remain the just judge while justifying wrong people? He can only do it one way, and that's based on the redemptive work of Christ on that cross. That's the only way. And so he's got these critics coming in, and he's saying they're trying to disregard Paul's apostleship, and most of his historic Christianity has gone along with that. They've tried to throw away his distinctive apostleship. But it's through that apostleship now that God is making now the but now righteousness of God and making that available to all. And he is now making this available to a world, and he's doing it for the Gentiles, salvation for the world, especially the Gentiles. And what he's driving home here is the Jews now participate in the blessings that are coming through the Gentiles. Israel's prophetic program was the total reverse of that. Israel's prophetic program was that the Gentiles would be blessed through Israel. Now the Jews are, now that the nation of Israel has been set aside, the Jews are being blessed through the ministry Paul's doing, especially among the Gentiles. And so in Romans 4, he's going to drive home this point that everything he's saying is consistent with God and what he's done in the past. Everything is consistent with that. And he pulls out an example of Abraham. He uses Abraham as the example, Abraham as the key witness from the law and the prophets to demonstrate what he's mentioning here. With regard to justification by faith, this faith righteousness of God. And that's what we get in Romans 4. And as we begin to see that, let's just look at the first verses here. If you remember, Romans 4, I mentioned before, so we're going to go through this fairly quickly. He's answering questions, or maybe better than answering, because he's already answered the questions at the end of Romans 3. Maybe a better thing, he's expanding upon the answers he gave to some questions at the end of Romans 3. Just flip back a page, and let's just look at the questions. He's just now explained that this but now righteousness of God based on the redemptive work of Christ on the cross displays and declares his righteousness as he justifies sinners on the basis of faith. And verse 27, where is the boasting then? It is excluded. By what law? Of works? No, by the law of faith. Now keep a finger here and just flip back to Romans 4, verse 1. Flip back up a page. What shall we say then that Abraham our father as pertaining to the flesh hath found? For if Abraham were justified by works, he have wherewith to glory. That word glory there in your King James, that's the exact same word back in verse 27 that he has translated boasting. This boasting concept, if Abraham was justified by works, then he would have something to boast about. But what did their father Abraham find out? What did he discover? What does the scripture say about him? It wasn't based on works. He believed God, and it was credited to him. It was credited to him for righteousness. So that's the first question. I'll look at verse 29 now. And Paul develops that question through the first 8 verses of chapter 4. Then look at verse 29. Is he the God of the Jews only? Is he not also of the Gentiles? Yes, of the Gentiles also. Seeing it is one God which shall justify the circumcision by faith and the uncircumcision through faith. Now flip over a page, keep your finger in chapter 3, but flip over to verse 9 of chapter 4 and see where he brings this up now, this concept here in verse 9. Cometh this blessedness then upon the circumcision only, or upon the uncircumcision also? For we say that faith was reckoned to Abraham for righteousness. How was it then reckoned? When he was in circumcision or in uncircumcision? Not in circumcision, but in uncircumcision. Now, there's a lot of big, long Latin words in there, but basically what he's saying is that Abraham was justified before circumcision came on the scene. See, Paul's critics are going to come along and say, it has to be works-oriented. It has to be based on circumcision. You know, circumcision is just a work, right? Or it has to be, the next thing we're going to talk about is the works of the law, that law and its works. And he's going to drive home this point that Abraham was justified apart from works, without works. Abraham was justified before circumcision. And we're going to see why that's so important. Let's just first look at the last question here in verse 31 of chapter 3. Romans 3, verse 31. Do we then make void the law through faith? God forbid, we establish the law. Now look at verse 13 of chapter 4, and we see where he picks up this law topic now. For the promise that he should be heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. For if they which are of the law be heirs, faith is made void and the promise made of no effect, because the law worketh wrath. For where there is no law, there is no transgression. Now, what I just want to bring out here is this, that what he's building up to, what he's driving home here, is the critics of Paul are saying, Paul, what you're saying can't be right. It can't be apart from works. It can't be apart from circumcision. It can't be apart from the law. That's the things, those things of Israel. Now, believers today need to be circumcised, or they need to go back to the law. That's what was happening in Galatia and many other places. And they were trying to bring those things back in. And Paul is going to counter that and knock down that argument to oblivion, because he's going to use it's an argument ad absurdum, because he's going to say that if justification required the law, if justification was based on law, if it was based on circumcision, if it was based on any works whatsoever, then even Abraham would be excluded from justification from God, before God. If Abraham, the scriptures say Abraham believed God and it was counted to him for righteousness. Abraham was justified before circumcision, so it can't be based on circumcision. And Abraham was justified 400 plus years before the law, so it can't be based on law. If it was based on when circumcision came in, which is right here, then even Abraham wouldn't be a participant in God's justification. It's an argument ad absurdum. He demolishes the argument by taking them all the way back here. He takes them before the law, Moses and the law. He takes them before David and the Davidic covenant, before Moses and the law. He takes them before Israel had been brought out of Egypt and formed into a nation. He takes them before even circumcision and before even the Abrahamic covenant, which is the basis of Israel's whole covenant system. So he takes them before Israel's whole prophetic program, and he declares in Genesis 15:6, before all this, God justified Abraham on the basis of faith. Now that's the important argument in Romans 4, because he's dealing here with Jews, and the important thing is their prophetic program. God now is operating on the basis of the mystery program, the body of Christ in the mystery program, not the Israel and her prophetic program for the earth. And why is that so important? These Jewish critics are coming along and saying, no, you need the law, you need the covenant system, you need to go back to Israel and her prophetic program. And Paul's point is that Abraham himself was justified before all that. Paul's apostleship stands. If they could show we have to go back to anything in Israel's prophetic program, then Paul's apostleship falls. And that's why historic Christianity has been led so far astray, because they've disposed of Paul's distinctive apostleship. They've gone back to the things of Israel, and it's, he's going to say in Galatians 3, we saw last week, to go back to these things demolishes, makes null and void the promise of the Spirit, nullifies the work of Christ on the cross, and makes everything worth nothing. That's what's at stake. Here in Romans 4, he's showing that Israel's prophetic program, look at verse 13. Israel's prophetic program, verse 13, chapter 4, Romans 4, verse 13. For the promise that he should be heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed. Now remember here, that seed he's referring to is Abraham's multiplied seed. Remember, seed is one of those words that can be singular or plural, right? I can have one seed in my hand, and I say, I have one seed in my hand. Or I can have a bag full of seeds. And what would I say? I have a bag of seed. You use the same word, whether it's singular or plural. And that's, Paul drives home the point that God selected that word. There is a million other words God could have used to talk about Abraham's children. He could have used the word children, you know, child, children. He could have differentiated between singular and plural. He could have used a bunch of words, descendants, descendant, descendants, heir, heirs. He could use all kinds of words, but his key word is seed, which is both singular and plural at the same time. And here in Romans 4, he says in verse 13, for the promise that he should be heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed. There, that's the multiplied seed, the plural seed, the many seed. How do I know? Keep reading. Through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. For if they which are of the law be heirs, that's our key. He's referring to the multiple seed of Abraham. It's the plural seed because he refers to them in the next verse as heirs, plural, with an S at the end. Not the heir, but heirs, plural, with an S. He's referring to their multiplied seed, the multiplied seed of Abraham, through the line of Isaac, through the line of Jacob, through those 12 children of Jacob that become the 12 tribes of Israel that will eventually be formed into that nation, of which God's going to take the nation of Israel, make her the head of the nations, and with her and through her bless all the Gentile nations. Israel's prophetic system, program. Now look what's at stake here. If the critics of Paul are correct, look what happens to Israel's whole prophetic system. Verse 14, for if they which are of the law be heirs, faith is made void and the promise made of none effect. The promise is nullified. What's the promise? He tells you the promise in verse 13, for the promise that he should be heir of the world. That's Israel's whole prophetic system in a nutshell. They would inherit the world. They would rule the earth. Christ is going to be sitting on his throne in Jerusalem, and he's going to be using the nation of Israel. Through the nation of Israel, he rules the world. He's inherit the world. And what Paul's driving home here is if justification isn't solely on the basis of faith and grace, then that means that, and you need the law or you need circumcision or it's associated with Israel's prophetic program or anything else, if you can bring works into this one bit, then that means that not only does Abraham not participate in the righteousness of God, even David and Moses and the 12 children of Jacob and Jacob and Isaac, they're all excluded because they were all before the law. They were all before, many of them were before circumcision, and Abraham himself was justified as an ungodly sinner. If it's not based on grace and faith, if it's based on the law, them keeping the law, then Israel's whole prophetic system to inherit the earth self-destructs and crumbles into a pile of ashes and dust. That's what's at stake. He's showing here that not only is faith righteousness the foundation of our mystery program, faith righteousness was the substructure foundation of Israel's prophetic program. And before Israel's prophetic program even began to be formed, Abraham was justified way back before all that. Galatians 3 is going to take it a step further. Romans 4 has to do with Israel and her prophetic program and how that was always on the basis of faith righteousness. When we went to Galatians 3, we saw there he's talking about the mystery program now, and he's showing that just as if you have to add law or circumcision or works to faith justification, righteousness by faith, if you add one work to that, if you add any of those things to that, not only does Israel's whole prophetic system crumble and crash to the ground, and the promise to their promise to inherit the earth is nullified, but when you get to Galatians 3, he's going to drive home the point, if we add works, if we go back to the Israel's prophetic program, if we go back to the law, if we go back to circumcision, if we bring in the things from Israel's prophetic program, our promise is nullified. The promise of the Spirit. Everything in this mystery program, this whole mystery program, self-destructs and crumbles to the ground in a pile of dust and ashes. That's what's at stake with this faith righteousness. Between Galatians 3 and Romans 4, he demonstrates that faith righteousness isn't just something Paul came up with and the critics need to argue against. It's the substructure foundation, not only of our mystery program, it's the foundation of Israel's prophetic program. Everything hinges on it. Everything is based on that. Romans 4 is the answer to the end of questions at the end of Romans 3, but I also want to bring out one other thing. It's also the answer to the questions at the end of Romans 2, which is sometimes missed. Go back to Romans 2 and look how he picks this up. It's almost as though the witness of the law and the prophets begin in the very first verses of Romans. He talks about the gospel that they can witness to. Of course, that's just the good news of the incarnation and the good news of the resurrection. They can't even witness to the good news of the death of Christ. That's going to come especially in chapter 5. That witness of the, they can witness to the sinfulness of humanity. They can witness to the pattern of fallen humanity. They can witness to the foolishness of using the time of God's long suffering for your own self-righteous ends. He can witness to that, and they can bring all those things up. But it reaches its high point, its pinnacle, with the witness of Abraham. And look how he brings in, look at chapter 2, verse 23. We're only going to be a minute here. Chapter 2, verse 23. Thou that makest thy boast of the law. Well, wait a minute. Faith righteousness, what does it say at the end of Romans 3? It says faith righteousness excludes boasting. And then how does Romans 4 open up? It says Abraham has nothing to boast about because he was justified by grace and faith. He was on the basis of faith. And here you have Jews boasting in the law. They think that they had a privileged status before God based on the law because they have the law. And of course, this whole section, and we're actually going to pick up on this law concept in a few minutes, this whole section revolves around the fact that the issue for Israel isn't having the law. It's not even teaching the law. The issue for Israel that they needed to face up to was that the question is, are they doing the law? And he shows in Romans 2 that they're not, and they're in the same predicament as the Gentiles and need to fall on the grace God's made available to us today in the personal work of Christ. So let's look, pick verse 23. Thou that makest thy boast in the law, through breaking the law dishonorest thou God? For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles through you, as it is written, for circumcision verily profits if thou keep the law, but if thou break the law, thy circumcision is made uncircumcision. Now, hopefully you see the trail. This is the same trail that he has in Romans 4. And he's saying here, if you are going to claim your position before God based on the law, your a privileged position before God on the law, well, then you have to do the law. And of course, Israel didn't do it. The very thing he says, you blaspheme the name of God among the Gentiles. Well, how did that happen? That was because in their disobedience to the law, they fell under its curses, and God dispersed them among the Gentiles. He destroyed the nation, he destroyed Jerusalem, and he destroyed the temple through his tool, I guess you could say, Babylon. And they went out into exile, and they under Gentile control, they were blaspheming the name of God. They broke the law. Now, I call this week, kind of think of this as the domino effect. See, they had their little dominoes, works, circumcision, law, and they had them all lined up, and they said, see, we're in a privileged position before God. And Paul is going to knock down the dominoes. He says here, he says, if you are claiming a position before God based on the law and you break the law, the first domino falls. That makes your circumcision uncircumcision. The second domino falls. And that means you're under the judgment and condemnation of God if that's how you're basing that. Your works aren't worth anything at that point. Let's see what makes the true Jew, I guess is what we're going to say. Look down, skip down to verse 28. For he is not a Jew, which is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision, which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew, which is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, and not of the letter, whose praise is not of God. See, it's all a heart issue. And you know how Paul describes that in Romans 4? Keep this in mind. The true Jew is one who's not just physically circumcised, not just one who has the law, but who's circumcised and have the law and something else regarding the heart and the spirit. Flip back to chapter 4, and let's just point this out real quick. So with that in mind, look down at verse 12 of chapter 4. And the father of circumcision, he's talking about Abraham here, to them who are not of the circumcision only, not only those, see, the issue for God is not the external circumcision. What's the key thing? But who also, those who are circumcised isn't what brings us in a right position before God, isn't what brings the Jews in a right position before God. Being externally circumcised, that's not the issue. The issue is those who are externally circumcised and walk in the steps of faith of our father Abraham, which he had yet been uncircumcised. See, what he's showing here is even for the nation of Israel, the key thing is that, yes, circumcision was required. You go back to Genesis 17, and you know if you didn't engage in circumcision, guess what happened? It says you were cut off from among the people. Now, the more charitable commentators say, well, they were probably exiled or excommunicated from the Israel, kicked from among the people. But you know what most commentators say is that meant death. You were circumcised or put to death. And at the very least, you are kicked out of the community. You were removed from the community. That's how important circumcision was. And he required it not just of the physical line of Abraham, but everyone associated with him, his servants and everything else. So this circumcision is serious stuff, but Paul drives home the point here is that even once circumcision was required, the issue wasn't the external circumcision only. It was that external circumcision in the context of the faith of Abraham. They have to have both things. Now he's going to say the exact same thing about the law. From Romans 2, you saw the issue isn't circumcision. The issue isn't having the law. It's not circumcision. It's the true Jew is one who heart has been uncircumcised. Heart has been circumcised. And from a response of faith from the heart, this is a faith response. The external sign isn't what matters. It's the external signs in the context of the faith of Abraham. For circumcision, look at what he says about having the law. Verse 16, therefore it is of faith that it might be by grace, to the end the promise might be sure to all the seed, not to that only which is of the law, but also to them which is of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. The key thing here wasn't just those who were under the law. The thing is, did you have the law and the faith of Abraham? See what Paul's doing is here. He's breaking down the whole apostate religious system of national Israel. He's showing them that the whole apostate religion they've established that rejected Christ, rejected the prophets, rejected Christ, and rejected the ministry of the Holy Spirit and the ministry of Peter and the 12, that same apostate religious system that relied on works and circumcision and the law, that apostate religion system was missing one fundamental thing, the faith of Abraham. That's what would bring about the promise. That's what brought about the blessing of justification. That's what the believing remnant had. They were circumcised. They were under the law, Peter and the 12 and his followers. But they also, as it says here, who also walk in the faith of Abraham. The apostate religious system had all these externals, but in words of chapter 2, they didn't have the heart, they didn't have the spirit, they didn't have the faith of Abraham, which made their whole system an apostate religious system that will reach its climax out there in that tribulation period. So that's what, when we look at kind of a summary of Romans 4, the first 8 verses, the true Jew before God is not one who is justified by his own works that put God in his debt, but is justified by God on the basis of grace, basis of faith, so they can be by grace. Then when he talks about circumcision in verses 8 to 12, the true Jew before God is not one who is externally circumcised, but one who is externally circumcised and has the righteousness of faith as well. And then as he talks about the law in verses 13 to 16, the true Jew before God is not one who only possesses the law, but also has the righteousness of faith, that faith righteousness of Abraham as well. And that's how Israel's whole prophetic system is going to be fulfilled. It's not contingent on them doing the works of the law. They've already been 1,500 years under the law. And just think of all their privileges, all their advantages, all their benefits. They had the presence of God. They had the word of God. They had the teaching of God, the leadership of God. They had the promises and the covenants and all that stuff. And 1,500 years with all those advantages, and what did Israel, through those 1,500 years, always come under? The curses of the law. See, God used the nation of Israel for those 1,500 years to show that when you give a sinner the law, when you place a sinner under a law system, all you do is bring him under the curses of the law. Because the only thing the law is going to do for a sinner is point out and magnify sin. And then you know what it does? Here's the amazing work of the law. You want to know what the law does? Now, religion tells you all kinds of things. It points out sin, it magnifies it, and then you know what it does? It turns it into a transgression. And once it's a transgression, now you can be condemned, you can have a punishment assigned, and that punishment is carried out, and in the law, that punishment almost always was death. That's the law at work. That's what the law accomplished. If you or anyone listening in the internet or radio or anyplace else thinks they're obeying the law, under the law, obeying the law, going back to the law, and you aren't condemned and worthy of death, then you're using the law wrong. Because that's what the law does to a sinner. And Galatians also, he's like, why would you want to go back to that when you've been set free by Christ and the gospel of grace of Christ? All right, so we're going to go ahead and start, I guess I call it a mini-series. I have so many different topics, I wasn't sure which one to go to, so I think this would be a good starting point. We're going to do a little mini-series on the law. I was going to do it in chapter 2, and then I was going to do it in chapter 3, and then I was going to do it in chapter 4 because I kept putting it off, and I think I'm going to actually do it now. We're in chapter 4, and that's a look at the law. The other thing I think we'll probably do after that is go to the book of James, and we're going to put these first 4 chapters of Romans together and go to the book of James and take a look at that and put them side by side and put together Israel and mystery program all together in one, panoramic view. based on the righteousness of God and the different aspects or the different displays of that between Israel's prophetic program and the Body of Christ mystery program. So I think we'll do that after that, and then we'll see. Then you know what I really want to do, though, but I'm actually holding back, is going to Romans 5, because it's going to get really exciting in Romans 5, because there he's going to lay out the basis of something that not only the law and the prophets couldn't reveal, make known, or manifest, they can't even witness to it. The first four chapters of Romans, he's been using the witness of the law and the prophets, culminating in that example of Abraham from the law and the prophets, and he's been using them to witness to various aspects of his mystery truth. And then you get to the end of Romans 4, and it's as though he's brought the law and the prophets in the first four chapters into the witness box and said, what did you see about this? What do you know about that? What did you witness with regard to this? And they presented their case. And one commentator said there's over 120 direct references to the Old Testament in the first four chapters of Romans, usually beginning with something like as it is written or what saith Scripture or something like that. Now, of course, it depends on how you count. I mean, you could count Romans 4 as once or twice in every verse, or you can count Romans 4 as once, because the whole thing is the witness of the Old Testament. But my point is, when you, that same commentator who said there was over 120 references, which would be about one reference per verse in the first four chapters, when you leave Romans 4, you don't hear anything about the witness of the law and prophets. He brings up things from the Old Testament, but it's never as it is written or what saith Scripture or anything like that. He removes them from the witness box, and there's only three instances he refers to the law and the prophets from chapters 5 to 8. See, something changes when we go from chapter 4 to chapter 5. That's going to be amazing. So I set it up, right? So you're all going to just be waiting with bated breath. Of course, if we're going to go through the law and the book of James, you might have a while to wait. But maybe I'll intersperse it anyway as we go through that. So let's start thinking about the law. There's so much misconception about the law. The basic problem, I guess if we're going to look at the basic problem of the law, let's go back to Exodus 19. The basic problem with the law, Exodus 19. The basic problem with the sinners relating to God on the basis of the law and works was stated at the giving of the law itself. Here is the fundamental, absolute problem with relating to God on the basis of the law. Look what the law says. Look at verse 8. Exodus 19, verse 8. And all the people, all the Israelites there, we're going to go back and get more context here, but I just want to bring out this point at the very beginning. For anyone who thinks that the going under a law or the giving of the law was a good thing for Israel, hopefully by the end of today, you'll see that's not the case. Verse 8, and all the people, all the Israelites answered together and said, all that the Lord hath spoken, we will do. Now we like that. Our flesh likes that. We think we can do something for God. We think that's really great. We'll do that and we'll be approved to God and we'll be really great. But 1,500 years of Israel under the law, and where they're trying to do for themselves, make themselves into the nation God intended them to be, 1,500 years, all they did is fall under the curses of the law. The problem with the law is it says, I will do. But you know what God says? And they should have learned this in the first 18 chapters of Exodus, or actually the first verses of chapter 19 too. The law says, I will do. Grace says, God will do. That's the way God wanted to relate with Israel. He spent from the time of the Exodus all the way to the arrival at Mount Sinai showing them how to his grace works and how to rely on his grace. And the last thing they should have done at Sinai is enter into that law contract, because what that was all absolute rebellion against God, because it's they were saying, everything you've done since the Exodus, we don't care about. We will do this ourselves. We don't need you. We don't want you. God wants to do it for them. And they said, no, we'll do it ourselves. And they spent the next 1,500 years under the curses of the law. Let's flesh that out a little. Let's see what we're talking about here. God provided Israel with his Jehovah I am, or I will be, name, so that he could do whatever Israel needed to do to make her into the nation he created her to be. We're not going to go back to the Exodus 3, but if you remember, we've been over this before in the past, if you go back to Exodus 3, what happened there at the calling out of Moses, what was the first thing God did? He gave Moses, for the nation Israel, his Jehovah name. I am. I will be. Now, you know, if I come up to you and say, I am, you're probably going to look at me and go, you are what, right? It's kind of an incomplete thought. I am. Well, see, that's the whole point. That's why God gave it to them. God said, I am. And then there's a blank spot. Israel was supposed to fill in the blank spot. God would be whatever they needed him to be to make them into the nation he created them to be. He gave him that Jehovah name. And here's some of the Jehovah. These are just the compound names. There's many others we could put on here. We could put page and slide after slide, page after page of what God wanted to be for Israel, what God wanted to do for Israel. I will be. I will be. I am. I will be. I want to be. I am. Jehovah will provide. He'll be their provider. I am your banner. That's that idea of the war. All they were supposed to do is come and rest under his banner, and he'd fight their battles. He'd be their conquering hero. I am your healer. All they had to do was come to him for healing. He'll be their peace, their shepherd. He wanted to do all that. He wanted to be their righteousness. He'd wanted to be the one to sanctify them. Not through their own works, but something he would do himself. I am there. He wanted to be there with them. I will do whatever needs to be done. And from that minute he gave that name to Moses, all the way to the Exodus 19:4. That's the lesson Israel should have learned. There's 52 days, at least from one count I saw, 52 days from the Exodus to they arrive at Mount Sinai. 52 days, almost 2 months, and they were under the teaching ministry of God himself. God was there with him. Remember the smoke, the pillar of smoke during the day and the fire at night, and he was there with them. He was leading them. He was fighting for them. He was guiding them. 52 days, he was there teaching them. And if you read those passages, obviously we're not going to cover all those chapters before chapter 19. But if you were to go back and look at all those chapters, you'd see it's constantly the idea, he teaches them something and then he tests them. You know, it's just like school. It's just like a school. He teaches them and he gives them a pop quiz. He teaches them and he gives them a pop quiz. He teaches them something and he gives them a pop quiz. He teaches them something and gives them pop quiz. And then you get to Mount Sinai and he's given the final exam. And the question is, were they going to pass or were they going to fail? So let's just look at a few of these things as far as what God wanted to do with Israel. We'll probably come back to that slide. Israel needed God to do everything, and he was willing to do it. So we're just going to skip a stone over the surface. Let's go to Exodus 13. Exodus 13. And we're just going to bring out this fact, what God is teaching them before they ever get to Mount Sinai. Before, remove from your thinking all that you know about the law, and let's just go back to what God was teaching them before they got to Mount Sinai. Look at verse chapter 13. Oh, let's pick it up at verse 14. They're just about being ready to be delivered out of Goshen, the land, and out and heading out of the land of Egypt. And look at verse 14. "And it shall be when thy son asks thee in time to come, saying, what is this, this whole deliverance out of Egypt, that thou shalt say unto him, by strength of hand, the Lord brought us out from Egypt, from the house of bondage. And it came to pass," well, let's just stop there. When we remember what's going under the law says, going under the law says, we will do. But what did God teach them here? He says what he wants them to learn, what he wants them to teach all their progeny, all their descendants, everyone that comes after this, is that it's by the strength of the hand of the Lord. He's the one that brought us out of Egypt. All right, well, we're just going to keep, this is like stones, we're just going to keep adding stone after stone after stone, so that when we get to Mount Sinai, we can pass the final exam. When we get to Mount Sinai, God delivered them. That's what he wanted to put up, memorialize. God said, through the hand of the Lord, the Lord did it. Look at, we'll just skip a stone over the surface here. Look over at chapter 14. Let's look at verse 13. "And Moses," this is still at the Exodus, the initial Exodus account here, "and Moses said unto the people, fear ye not, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show to you today. For the Egyptians who you have seen today, ye shall see them no more at forever. The Lord, who shall fight?" The Israelites will fight their battle. Verse 14, "the Lord shall fight for you." The Lord will do it. The Lord, the strong arm of the Lord will deliver them. The Lord will fight their battles. Keep that in mind. Let that keep building up in your thinking, because this is what Israel should have learned. It's the Lord has to do it, or they were hopeless. Absolutely hopeless. The Lord shall fight for you. Now what should the Israelites have learned they should have been doing? I don't know, I find this kind of funny in verse 13. Here they are, they have the armies with the chariots and everything of the Egyptians, and they can probably, you know, I watched some, I don't remember which ancient Israel battle it was, but they had chariots and everything, and you know, we got the fancy sound around, and that's really loud. Now imagine these poor Israelites. And they look back, and there's the chariots and the horses and the armies of Egypt coming, swooping down towards them. Now look what God tells them to do. Verse 13, "And Moses said unto the people, fear ye not, stand still, and watch the salvation, the deliverance of the Lord." That's what the Israelites should have learned. God just wanted them to fear not, stand still, and watch the Lord work. Let the Lord do it. All Moses, what's the only thing Moses had to do? Did he have to rev everyone, give them a pep talk, give them, you know, some modern ballistic weapons or anything? No. All he had to do was raise the arm of faith. He just had to put a God's rod of faith and hold that in the air. All God's looking for, according to Romans 4, all the way back to Abraham and really all the way back to Adam, is faith. Moses held up the rod of God of faith, and he told the Israelites, just fear not, stand still. And then what's he tell them, basically? I'm going to put it in modern vernacular there when he tells them, stand still and see. He's telling them to just stand still, see, and shut up. And the Lord opened up the sea, they passed through dry shod, and the Egyptian armies were swallowed in the waves. Verse 14, "the Lord shall fight for you." So I hope when that we're starting with the question, that remember Israel's response at the giving of the law is that we will do. Everything God was teaching them from the Exodus, well, from the giving of his name with Moses all the way to Mount Sinai was no. If it's dependent on you doing, you're dead meat. if you're going to become the nation I created you to be, I will do it. The Lord shall fight for you. Flip over to chapter 15. Look at this lesson he's giving these Israelites. Their first lesson as a true nation. They've been brought now as a group out of Egypt. And verse 15, now the deliverance has happened. Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord and spoke, saying, I will sing unto the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. He triumphed. The horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea. He threw them in the sea. The Lord is my strength. God is the strength here, the source of strength in his song. He is my salvation. The Lord will be their salvation. And I will prepare him a habitation for my father's gods, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name. That Lord, you remember the capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, that's his Jehovah name. I am whatever you need me to be. I will be that. And he's just showed it to him in the dividing of the Red Sea and the swallowing up of the hosts of the Egyptians. So now in chapter 14, what did he tell the Israelites? He said, fear not, stand still and shut up. Now after, and watch. Now they've watched it, and what's Moses do? The only thing he does, only thing God wants Israel to do is sing his praises. It's all he wants Israel to do. He will do everything else. Sing his praises. Make a memorial for him. Recognize that he's, rely on him and recognize his power and his deity and rely on that. Chapter 16. Go down to verse 9. Remember, he's brought them now in the wilderness, and he's still teaching them. If you are going to be the nation I created you to be, then it has to be me doing it, not you doing it. And he's just showed them that in several ways. There's no way they could have survived the Egyptian army. There's no way they could survive any of these things. And now in chapter 16, look at verse 9. And Moses spoke unto Aaron. Now they're remember, he's brought them, he's on the other side, and he's brought them along, and they have a shortage of water, they have a shortage of meat, they have a shortage of bread, and you see what God's teaching them here is, if you have a shortage, rely on me. I will do, it's a test. He said, now that you've seen what I will do for you, you know, I just conquered the whole Egyptian nation in one swoop. I mean, don't you think I'm good for providing water or food or bread? See what he's teaching them. He's trying to teach them these things. And he says in verse 9, Moses spoke unto Aaron, saying unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, come near. Very, very important. We'll, if we have enough time, we'll be there. After the giving the law, what does God say? Get away. Get away. Here, even though they're murmuring, even though they're complaining, even though they're not cooperating one bit, bring them near. Come near before the Lord, for he hath heard your murmurings. And it came to pass, as Aaron spoke unto the whole congregation of the children of Israel, that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud, and the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, I have heard your murmurings of the children of Israel. Speak unto them. At even you shall see flesh, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and ye shall know that what? I am. There's that I am name. I am whatever you need me to be. Why are you murmuring? Just rely on me in faith. And he sent the food, and he's already given them clean water. He's already cleansed their water, being Jehovah, I am their healer. Now he's bringing in Jehovah, I am your God. See, that God revealed himself to Israel as the I am blank spot God for Israel. I will do whatever they need to make them into the nation I created them to be. I will do it. I will do it. Chapter 17. Now they were coming. You know, you'd think they just saw God conquer and destroy and swallow up the whole Egyptian army. Now Amalek comes. And they have another enemy that wants to fight with them. And we're not going to get into the whole thing about Amalek, but let's look at chapter 17, verse 8. Then came Amalek and fought with Israel. This is Exodus 17, 8. Fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said unto Joshua, choose us out men and go fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. Now remember, that when he talks about the rod of God, if you read back in Exodus, I think it was chapter 5 or 6, the rod of God is so that the people would believe. So I kind of expanded based on that, and I called the rod of God of faith. All Moses is going to have to do is stand there like he did for the Egyptian army and hold up the rod of God of faith. So Joshua did as Moses said unto him, and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Ur went up to the top of the hill. And it came to pass when Moses held his hand that Israel prevailed. When the faith, see what he's teaching him here. When the rod of God of faith is up, I will destroy your enemies. When the rod of God of faith is down, your enemies will destroy you. There you have Joshua and his men out there fighting, and it didn't really depend on Joshua and his men. It depended on whether there was faith or there wasn't faith. What a lesson we can all learn from. But Moses' hands were heavy, and they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat thereon, and Aaron and Ur stayed up his hands, the one on the one side and the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua discomfited Amalek and the people, the edge of the sword. And the Lord said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in a book and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will. That's that Jehovah name, that I am. Look what it says there. I will utterly destroy or put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And look at this amazing verse in verse 15. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi, the Lord my banner, the Lord Israel's conquering hero. Israel, if she's going to be the nation and conquer the enemy so she can be the ruler of the earth, inherit the earth like the Abrahamic covenant calls for, God would have to do it for her. And what a lesson here. When faith was being held up, the enemy was slain. When faith was put away, Israel always lost. They were destroyed. And only all God wants is a response of faith. Just like we saw in Romans 2 and Romans 4, that heart response, that faith response, that's all he was looking for. I will destroy Amalek. I will be your banner. That Jehovah Nissi there, that's the concept. Remember when it came to the Egyptian army, he just said, they're panicking. Who wouldn't panic? You got the chariots of Egypt heading right toward you. Don't panic. Fear not. Stand still. Watch the salvation of the Lord. And he defeats the whole Egyptian army. I will do it. And he gives him this Jehovah Nissi, this Jehovah your banner, this conquering hero concept. All he wanted them to do was stand still and watch on the basis of faith. And he's just rest under my banner and I'll destroy your enemies. I will do it. I will do it. Go to chapter 18. And now we're going to tie this back into the law again. Chapter 18. Look at verse 8. Now we've reached the foot of Mount Sinai, and we have in chapter 18, I call it the two different endings. You know, there's some books, I kind of like this. because then my wife and I can share a book and we don't have to buy two copies. Because every now and then there's a book and you read it and they give you the option of two storylines. If you're kind of like my wife and you're nice and you like things a little happier and gentler, then you read the book this way. But if you want it a little rougher, a little more manly, well, you turn the book over, you start at the back, and you read it that way, and it's the same characters, the same storyline, it's just a little rougher, maybe doesn't have the happy ending my wife would like. So my point is, when you get to chapter 18, that's kind of like what you got. He's going to show you two endings to the story. He's going to show you ending one, this is one option, and then he's going to show you option two, the second option. And let's look, we're here, we're at the foot of Sinai. He's brought them through all these trials. He's taught them about his grace. He's emphasized, he wants looking for a faith response so that he can treat them on the basis of grace. He brings them along. He carries them. He's going to say in chapter 19, verse 4, he's carried them along as on eagle's wings. And now there's two stories. Which is Israel going to pick? Which ending? It's really not the ending to the story. I guess we better say, which storyline is Israel going to pick? It's a million-dollar question for Israel. Look at verse 8. Verse 8, and Moses told his father-in-law, that's Jethro. If you read the previous verses, you know that Jethro is a Midianite. He's a Gentile. What's the whole purpose of Israel? The whole purpose of Israel is that they would be a light unto the Gentiles. So when you see Israel being a light unto the Gentiles, that means they're fulfilling God's plan for them. That's their purpose, to be a light unto the Gentiles, to be a blessing unto the Gentiles. Verse 8, and Moses told his father, Jethro, the Midianite Gentile, his father-in-law, who was a Gentile Midianite, all that the Lord had done unto Pharaoh and to the Egyptians. Notice, he told the Midianites, these Gentiles, he told them about all that the Lord did. Not what the Israelites did, what the Lord did. Verse 8, had done unto Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake. He did it for Israel. And all the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how the Lord delivered them. I am the Jehovah, I am Lord, capital L-O-R-D. He did it all. And he's telling a bunch of Gentiles this. And Jethro what? He rejoiced. Jethro rejoiced for all the goodness which the Lord hath done to Israel, which he had delivered when he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. They were being a light to the Gentiles. You know, some people say, and you know, you have to be a scholar and, you know, and that kind of thing, but they come along and say, Israel had to have the law because that's the way a nation becomes a true nation. The law is like Israel's constitution, and God had to give them a law because if he didn't, he wouldn't be able to make them into a nation. I am completely disagree with that, because here we see Israel as a nation fulfilling its purpose to the Gentiles before they ever got to the law. God did not need, or Israel did not need the law for God to turn her into a country. I read a commentator recently. He said, just like the Gentiles have, Israel needed a constitution, a law, so God had to give it to them. Well, you know, there is another time Israel thought they needed something the Gentile nations needed. They thought they needed a king like the Gentiles. And remember what they picked? Saul. An absolute disaster. And what I'm going to propose now, and hopefully we'll see over the next few weeks, is that when they came up to that law, and they were looking for a law like the Gentiles had, God giving them a law like the Gentiles had, it was just as disastrous as when they picked Saul. God did not need a law to make Israel into the nation. he designed her to be. Before we ever get to the law here with Jethro and these Gentiles as a nation, the leaders, it's going to talk about the leaders and Moses, they're rejoicing together, they're fellowshipping together, they're worshiping God together. Israel, after just 52 days under being carried along by God's grace, was already the nation God designed her to be, created her to be, before they ever got to the law. Jethro rejoiced for all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel, what the Lord did, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, "Blessed be the Lord." See, they're already fulfilling their national purpose. Here you got a Gentile blessing the Lord, worshiping the Lord, rejoicing with them in the Lord, who had delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, who had delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all other gods. These Midianites were a bunch of idol-worshiping Gentiles. And Israel is already the light to the Gentiles, a blessing to the Gentiles. Verse 12, and Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God, and Aaron and all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. What an incredible, amazing picture. National Israel, before they ever get that law, is already fulfilling the reason God created her. They're already a blessing to the Gentiles, a light to the Gentiles. Here the Gentiles come, they're worshiping, fellowshipping with the Jews and worshiping to God together with the Jews. And all before the law, based on the grace resident in his Jehovah name. That's all it took. That's what they should have learned, from the Exodus to Mount Sinai. That's what they should have learned. But I said there's a second storyline, right? Let's look at that second. Now, before we go on to the second storyline, let's just say after this account, this thing about Jethro here, this thing among the Gentiles, except maybe, I guess you could argue, when God treated Israel graciously during the reign of David and Solomon. Besides that rare account there, that very short account where God is just going to give Israel an interlude of grace, even though they don't deserve it, in the reign of David and Solomon, there was no other time in Israel's history, and really, by the end of David's reign and Solomon's reign, it had all gone downhill, didn't it? Solomon was basically apostate by the time he gets to the end of his reign. So even though those couple little glimmers, so I think we can safely say that what is displayed here with Jethro has never occurred again in Israel's history. And the next time you're going to see it occur is over there at the end of that tribulation period, as they enter into the kingdom when Christ returns. What does it say there the Israelites are going to do at that time? They're going to plead with God to deal with them graciously. They're going to fall on the grace resident in his Jehovah name. They're going to fall on the grace resident in Israel's covenant system, especially that new covenant at that time. We won't see this ending for this storyline until the entrance into that kingdom. But there's another storyline. And we'll probably wrap up with this. Look at now let's pick it up at verse 13. And you know, we read this, we're so familiar with this, nothing really shocks us, we've heard it all before. But when you go from verse 12 to chapter 13, you should feel like all of a sudden you left one planet and went to another planet. Because it is so incredibly different. Look at verse 13. He's just talked about what's going on with the elders of Israel and the Gentiles, and they're worshiping God, fellowshipping God, praising God. And now look at verse 13. Let's go down to the people. And it came to pass on the morrow that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from morning until evening. Morning until evening. Moses is sitting there judging among the people. Doesn't sound like a happy way to spend my day. Look at verse 14. And when Moses' father-in-law saw what he did to the people, he said, "What is this thing that you do to the people? Why sittest thou alone, and all the people stand before thee from morning to evening?" And Moses said unto his father-in-law, "Because the people come unto me to inquire of God. When they have a matter, they come unto me, and I judge between one and another." All right, let's get the picture here. Let's see what's going on here. We've just had, I guess you could almost call it a heavenly picture of the Gentiles with Israel worshiping God. And now we see a picture of Moses sitting outside from day to evening, from morning to evening, all day long, and people lined up for miles around waiting to come so that he can give them their due. They want to be treated the way they deserve to be treated. Maybe somebody stole something from them. Maybe somebody, you know, broke their fence down, or maybe somebody did something else. And Moses, they want Moses to come and tell them how to run every detail of life. And they stand in line, snake round, morning to night, all day, all week. And look what Moses' father-in-law, he says in Moses, verse 17, in-law said unto him, "The thing that thou doest is not good. That will surely wear away." Moses is going to wear away. "But thou and this people that is with thee, for this thing is too heavy for thee, for thou art not able to perform it thyself." And then he gives him some advice there about selecting other people, other rulers. And let's go down to verse 21. "Moreover, thou shalt provide out of all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them." Now listen to this. "To be rulers of thousands and rulers of hundreds and rulers of fifties and rulers of tens." He's giving a picture of life in a law system. And it's totally different from life in a grace system. He's showing them here before they get to that Mount Sinai, he's showing them, if you enter into a law system, this is what your life is going to look like. You're going to have rulers and judges, rulers of tens of thousands, thousands, hundreds, tens. Everything's going to be regulated. You're going to be given 613 commandments that are going to penetrate to every detail of your life. Everything's going to be regulated. And it's all going to be self-centered, as somebody did me wrong and I'm going to get my due. I'm going to go to the Moses and he's going to fix it. And it's the very opposite of grace. When they should have been operating based on grace, worshiping God together with those Midianites and the elders of Israel and Moses, worshiping God, fellowship, and being involved in that grace, they were down here on the basis of law trying to get what's due to them. And if they entered in that law system, that's what their life was going to look like. Hunt thousands, a whole armies of rulers and armies of judges and regulating every detail of life. Verse 26, "And they judge the people at all seasons." It's all the time. "The hard causes they brought to Moses, every small matter was judged themselves, and Moses let his father-in-law depart," and so forth. That's the second storyline. If you enter into this law system, that's what your life is going to look like. You are going to, if you enter into a law system with God, he's going to give you commandments that are going to regulate every single detail of your life. And if you miss up once, death, the curses of the law. Two different pictures here. This, now I want you to realize this. We said before in the first half of Exodus 18, that picture is not going to start again until the end of that tribulation as they go in the kingdom. When as a nation, the believing remnant will be created into the believing nation, and they will dispense God's light and blessings to the world. This storyline here is picked up in chapter 19. This is the storyline that they chose. This is the way they wanted to be treated by God. This is what they entered into on the basis of selfish concern and selfish desire rather than purely the grace of Christ and worshiping Him. This is what they wanted to enter into. This is the rest of the story. This is the next 1,500 years of Israel's history. And the next 1,500 years of Israel's history is 1,500 years under the curses of the law. So now, Romans stuck on my mind, but we're going to close by looking again and bring it back to where we started, Exodus 19. And let's just, verse 1. We'll just read through a couple verses and just put it all together. In the third month, the children of Israel were gone forth out of the land of Egypt. The same day came they into the wilderness of Sinai. So now they're in the wilderness of Sinai. For they were departed from Rephidim and were come to the desert of Sinai and had pitched in the wilderness, and there Israel camped before the mount. Okay, so here they are. Here's the test. God has been giving these, He's been teaching them stuff and giving them a quiz, teaching them stuff and giving them a quiz, teaching them stuff and giving them a quiz. And now here, He's given them two different storylines. They can even have the storyline of Jethro and Moses, or they can have the storyline of Moses and the people standing in line all day, having every detail of their life regulated. They can operate in that. And here's the question at Sinai. What are they going to pick? Verse 3. And Moses went up unto God, and the Lord called unto him out of the mountain, saying, Thus shalt thou say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel. Now here's storyline 1. Verse 4. Ye have seen. Remember he said way back at the very beginning of the deliverance, he said, Fear not, stand still, shut up, and watch. Just see. You, verse 4, ye have seen. Now they've seen way more than what they had at the beginning. They've seen a lot more. He's been their provider, their conquering hero. He's done all this stuff for them, their healer. Ye have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how what I bear you along on eagle's wings. I bear you along. He carried them along. Were they murmured, they complained, they wanted to go back to Egypt instead of going ahead with God. And you know, years ago I saw a goose, and I just thought it was funny, where she had a bunch of little chicks, or I don't know, maybe it was the guy goose. I don't know who takes care of the babies, but he's going along and he's swooping up these baby geese. They're like all over. They're running here, running there. And, you know, they're almost in the road. And he's like pulling it, and they're pulling them, and he's pulling. And they get all the way down this road while I'm at a stop sign. How did that goose do it? I don't know, because those children were everywhere. That's what God had done with Israel as he brought her out of the nation. He shepherded them along as on eagle's wings on the basis of the grace resident in his Jehovah name. You have seen, verse 4, what I did unto the Egyptians and how I bear you along on eagle's wings and brought you, this is just so amazing, I brought you unto myself. That's storyline 1. Now, verse 5, now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenants, then you shall be a peculiar a treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. And Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before their faces all these words which the Lord commanded him. And this was the answer. That's the quiz. That's the final exam. Here we are at the final exam for Israel. Was it going to be God and His grace, the resident and His Jehovah name, I will do whatever you need? Or were they going to pick a different way based on what they would do? Verse 8, and all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord hath spoken, we will do. And we're not going to read now because the time's up. But if you go in the next few verses, which we will over the next couple weeks, when now it's based on what we will do, they're separated from God. They're driven away from God. The smoke and the fire, and they're cast away. He says, get those people away. Get the elders away. Get everybody away. They better be totally sanctified. Get them away. They lay one foot on the mount. And just in verse 4 before this, he said, I brought you as on eagle's wings to myself. Once they entered that law, he said, get away. Now, what's the point for us? Why in the world, when we have a relationship with God on the basis of grace, Him doing everything, we just praising and glorifying Him for that, why would we want to go back and think we can do anything for ourselves? Go back to that law, go back to works, go back to anything associated with that.